This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Sweden is set to become the 32nd member of NATO. Turkey cleared the way after initially voicing opposition to the Nordic country's accession. On this edition of the program, we analyze the recent NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania, at which Russia's unlawful invasion of Ukraine was front and center.
We will not waver. We will not waver. I mean that. Our commitment to Ukraine will not weaken. We will stand for liberty and freedom today, tomorrow, and for as long as it takes.
That was U.S. President Joe Biden speaking at the close of the 74th annual NATO summit, fittingly hosted by a Baltic nation, Lithuania, which has been warning the West about Russia's revanchist policies for more than a decade. Despite strong NATO support for Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky did not get the immediate invitation to join the alliance that he had hoped for. Instead, NATO leaders welcomed Ukraine's eventual membership, saying it should be able to join the alliance in the future without offering a specific timeline. Meantime, G7 nations agreed to a new long-term defense pact with Kyiv, offering equipment, training, and intelligence support. To dissect the outcome and ramifications of the NATO summit, we turn to two seasoned national security analysts. Catherine Sendak is Director of Transatlantic Defense and Security at CEPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis. That's a think tank based in Washington. And Will Pomerantz, who's no stranger to these microphones. Will is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. The institute focuses on Russia, Ukraine, and other states in the region. And both guests join me via Zoom. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Sendak at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Let me begin with you. What would you say are the broad takeaways from this consequential summit? How do the actual results measure up to your expectations?
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here. There were very high expectations going into the Vilnius summit, 500 days into Russia's full-scale invasion into Ukraine, coming off the heels of the Madrid summit last year. And there were very, very high expectations, both from allies and partners. I think that a lot of the things that were expected from allies did come to fruition in terms of the regional plans for the alliance moving forward, in terms of defense spending requirements, making 2% the floor, not the ceiling. And other issues, as you mentioned, you know, Turkey coming through and saying that they will ratify Swedish accession into the alliance, though the date is to be determined. I think for the Ukraine side of the house, I think that there was a mixed bag of perceptions about success. I think a lot of people would like the communique language on Ukraine to be stronger and not just feel it as a reiteration of the language from the Bucharest summit in 2008. But the alliance took very strong measures in eliminating the membership action plan for Ukraine, in providing long-term assistance. You mentioned the G7 framework for assistance moving forward, and the establishment of the NATO-Ukraine Council. Those are all steps in a very positive direction, with the alliance of no longer saying maybe will Ukraine join the alliance, but when.
Thank you very much, Catherine. And now I'm turning to Will Pomerantz, our Russia expert, for your take on the summit. Will, if you were Vladimir Putin, how would you be feeling after this summit?
Well, I think Vladimir Putin is already concerned for a whole variety of reasons in light of the mutiny that took place a few weeks ago. But I don't think it was any reassurance for Vladimir Putin as to basically being able to chip away at NATO solidarity. Indeed, it was remarkable that this group was so united for Ukraine. And this would not have happened unless Vladimir Putin had decided to invade Ukraine. So in the light of the feeling of unintended consequences, Vladimir Putin has basically revitalized the NATO alliance and has given it a new mission. And so I think that coming out of the Vilnius summit, as Catherine said, Zelensky didn't get everything, but he got a lot of commitments that Vladimir Putin will have to take into account.
Back to you, Catherine. Of course, Volodymyr Zelensky didn't get everything he wanted, but I don't think anybody was surprised that there was not an immediate invitation. The nations at war, this would have been a very bad signal. NATO would not want to be in direct confrontation with Russia. particularly given Article 5. But let me go back and let's look at the significance of Sweden's accession and Turkey's last minute dropping of its opposition. Of course, everybody knows that Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who just won re-election, you know, he likes to be the kingmaker. And of course, on the eve of the summit, he comes out with this dropping of his opposition to Sweden. What's the significance of Sweden's accession on the heels of Finland joining the alliance?
So it's absolutely huge. You know, Finland, when they finally acceded to the alliance here just this spring, I believe, you know, they made it very, very clear that their accession to NATO was not complete until Sweden was a part of NATO as well, which really speaks to the unification of the North region. It is huge. And you are absolutely right. Erdogan looked to be the hero while, you know, making his claims known, even touching on EU accession for Turkey, which was an interesting route to go down. So he came off that way. Now, for me, you know, I remain a little skeptical. Obviously, Hungary hasn't done ratification of Sweden accession either. But there's been no date determined by the Turkish government for ratification. They're now saying the fall. So we shall see how this plays out. But Sweden getting into the alliance, making this official, while for the past year plus, the alliance has been working with Sweden on steps become an integrated member of the alliance. It's huge to have 32 countries in NATO, and it's vitally important this happens very, very soon.
Well, Pomerantz, I happen to know that you were in Turkey recently in Istanbul, which doesn't make you an immediate expert, but you know the landscape.
I've taken the metro.
All right, let's see here. What is Erdogan getting in return? We know about these F-16 fighter jets. Will Congress now approve this request of Erdogan after his making the day, so to speak, paving the way for Sweden's accession? Notwithstanding, we don't have an exact date. Do you see any problems in that regard? What did he get in return for that? We know he's transactional.
He's transactional, but he was the center of attention. And I think that's what Mr. Erdogan got. And I think he got a lot of plaudits for being unsuspectedly reasonable and for saving the day, essentially, to making sure that NATO expands. Yes, we don't know when Sweden will be formally accepted, but going into the summit, there was every expectation that Sweden was not going to get in and that Erdogan would play hardball in terms of any negotiation. Again, we don't know what concessions were made to Erdogan, but in the last minute, he clearly saved the summit in many ways and made sure that the expansion of NATO will continue. I should also add that Erdogan not only saved the summit, but he really irritated Vladimir Putin because he's released some of the Azov battalion prisoners and sent them back to Ukraine. There was every expectation that Turkey was going to be an energy hub for Russia for its transit of energy to Europe. I think that is in question. And the Russian Duma put in a proposition declaring that Turkey was an unfriendly nation to the Russian Federation. That just simply adds to the list. Nevertheless, I think it will have consequences for Erdogan's and Turkey's relationship to Russia. And Russia, which is running short of friends around the world, probably lost one in Vilnius.
Very quick follow-up, Will. Does this signal perhaps a shift in Turkey's foreign policy toward the West away from his heretofore closeness to Russia?
I definitely see a shift. And I think Mr. Erdogan still has asked for the EU as well going forward. So I think that unless Russia can calm down and accept what has happened in Vilnius, I have every expectation that they will do more to distract and interrupt the relationship between Turkey and will essentially drive Turkey even more to the Western alliance.
Before we go to a break, Catherine Sendak, you're such an expert on the transatlantic alliance. What do you think about a potential shift on the part of Erdogan toward the West, which to me seems so surprising because for so long, EU accession was, you know, downplayed and it was the opposition, the political opposition that said, we're going to revive this.
It's to be seen whether or not this is a true shift. Erdogan has a tendency to ebb and flow his allegiances based on the day of the week and what he needs to garner to further his own power and to further his own role of Turkey in the foreign policy world. I think Erdogan has big ambitions about Turkey being a power player, as we've seen in terms of the way he wants to get involved with both Russia and Ukraine, offering to mediate, being the mediator for the grain deal in the Black Sea. And so I see this as a post-election kind of stretching his legs and seeing where he is in terms of his foreign policy. I do expect that he is going to try to maintain civility with Putin and be able to work with him and claim work with him where the West cannot do that. He can, and that kind of impression that he wants to have. But we shall see if this is a true shift.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Catherine Sendak, from whom you just heard. She's Director for Transatlantic Defense and Security at the Center for European Policy Analysis. And Will Pomerantz, he's Director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, also based here in Washington. And we're discussing the results of the NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps. You may download the show at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us at Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a listener and new Twitter follower, Rishikesh Swami Nathan. He's a civil servant from Chennai, the capital city of Tamil Nadu, the southernmost state in India. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our guests and talking more about the outcome and ramifications of the NATO summit. And let me start again with you, Catherine. What about China? We know that NATO sees Russia as perhaps one of the greatest formidable challenges, but what is it saying about the PRC and how, you know, NATO will deal with that? Because we know the PRC has a relationship with Russia. It may not be a strategic alliance, but they are certainly very strong partners on the same side vis-a-vis Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What does NATO say now about the PRC from this summit?
Yes. So it's interesting. You know, it was a big deal last year in Madrid, but when NATO recognized China as an emerging problem for the alliance to take a look at. This year, they reiterated that in the communique several times, especially from an economic perspective, but also from a threat perspective. They also acknowledged in the communique the emerging and growing relationship between Russia and China, especially in the days post Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I thought it was also interesting that, again, the alliance invited four Indo-Pacific partners to the summit in Vilnius and had meetings with them, had a session with them about the Indo-Pacific region. I think that was a great messaging aspect of the summit to show that they are interested in how they're going to pursue this problem set. They want to work with partners, willing partners who want to take a look at it. NATO signed a new agreement with Japan for cooperation at the summit as well. So I think in respect of the alliance moving forward, I think that they are taking a bigger and bigger aperture about how they need to address this issue. Some allies are more forthcoming on this threat than others. But as in the case of the NATO alliance, we got to get all 31 on board. And I think that the Secretary Stoltenberg and others are looking to do that.
Yes, indeed. Secretary Stoltenberg, given a one-year extension for his terrific work, perhaps hard to replace. Back to you, Will Pomerantz. Now, I know I don't like to put you in this position, but put yourself in the shoes of Vladimir Putin once again with respect to what NATO is saying about his good friend Xi Jinping and any kind of threat posed by the PRC.
So my feeling is, going forward, China and Russia have said that there are no limits to the relationship. Nevertheless, there are certain bumps in the road that are now occurring. And it is, I think, a question now to what extent China will give a blank check to Russia in terms of what it's doing in Ukraine. Indeed, Russia is disrupting lots of Chinese trade flows, etc. So I think that there is this feeling that there is a strong agreement between China and Russia. But I think China essentially is watching Russia. And as China studies the collapse of the Soviet Union as a cautionary tale, I think they are studying Russia and its invasion of Ukraine as a cautionary tale. And we will just wait to see what the results are.
Very fascinating. Back to you, Catherine Sendak. And speaking of Russia's ill-fated invasion of Ukraine, a second invasion, third invasion now, you know, full-scale invasion that really, as you all said earlier, just strengthened the NATO alliance even more rather than weakened it. What can we say about this counteroffensive by Ukraine under so much pressure? Is progress being made? Because we know that now all eyes are on Ukraine. More and more support is being supplied, military, economic, humanitarian, so that Ukraine will indeed prevail. What does that mean? What does that look like? How would you assess Ukraine's progress in the face of the enemy?
Yes. So it's been interesting because between the Prigozhin attempted, you know, mutiny a few weeks ago in Russia, the Vilnius summit, the pressure around Ukrainian NATO membership and relationships, the counteroffensive top of the news has creeped down a little bit. But paying attention to it, it is a slog. And we knew that going into the counteroffensive. We knew this was going to be a long, slow confrontation. And it's ended up being that way. You know, and I think that the Ukrainians are making incremental progress. There seems to be no advances of the Russians. There seems to be no successes on the Russian side. In fact, news hit just this week that a general in the Russian army was relieved of his duties after criticizing the war in Ukraine and some of the leadership tactics that they've used. There seems to be, you know, an ongoing, as we've seen over the past year and a half, a real morale problem on the Russian side. And how that plays out in terms of actual battlefield wins and losses, we're going to see. I think everyone acknowledges that the West is watching this counteroffensive very carefully to see what kind of gains Ukraine can make in liberating some of their occupied territory. But I think that the commitment from the West has to remain strong. Just on the previous point about Russia-China, China's not taking away lessons on what to do in a potential contingency in Taiwan. They're looking to learn lessons about Western resolve and commitment. And, you know, if we waver on our support, and those are the items that we need to maintain strength on. And to that point, I think the commitments that partners and allies made to Ukraine during the summit, additional resources, additional weapons, additional platforms, I would have liked them sooner, but I will take them. And I think Ukraine will too. And I'm really hoping that this type of support really leads to positive gains for the Ukrainian military.
So over to you again, Will Pomerantz, for a more of a Russian perspective with respect to this counteroffensive right on the heels of the aborted mutiny by Prigozhin and his Wagner group. Catherine just mentioned the fact that there was a dismissal of a top general who commanded one of Russia's elite military forces in Ukraine, perhaps laying bare continuing divisions in the armed forces. How do you see this power struggle, the ratio of forces and the ability for Ukraine to take advantage of these divisions and prevail?
Well, I think, as Catherine said, it is a slog. And the Russians have had a lot of time now to prepare their defenses. So they've built trenches, they've mined different territories. We are not in the same position as we were at the beginning of the war, when Ukraine miraculously was able to take Kharkiv back and was also able to secure victories in Kherson. So I think we have to have reasonable expectations as to how Ukraine is going to fight this war. It's not simply sending its most seasoned troops or its most trained troops into battle, but is basically trying to figure out when and under what circumstances it would be best to use them. So I think we need to give Ukraine the benefit of the doubt in the sense that they are the ones who are conducting this offensive, and that they are the ones who are best able to gauge the current state of battle on the field. So I think the counteroffensive is still too early to make a definitive declaration. I do think that in light of the Prigozhin affair and the firing of several generals, the disappearance of a few others, I think that the Russian military is in serious trouble. Clearly, it wasn't able to defend a ragtag mercenary group marching on Moscow. And Putin has tried to create a heroic narrative of the Russian people and the Russian military rising up to thwart this mutiny when there is no real evidence that that actually occurred. So I think that the mutiny of Prigozhin, who one should emphasize, Prigozhin is a creation of Vladimir Putin. He basically showed the frailty of the military. He was most vociferous about having a change in the top leadership of the military. And so I think that going forward, there is a question of how the Russian military responds and whether they're able to maintain the stalemate going forward, and whether, if indeed things turn bad, the Russian army simply retreats.
Well, back to you, Catherine Sendak, as we close and circling back to NATO being unified and supporting Ukraine, which is going to be essential, but also the fissures we see within the Russian military. And I'm going to quote from a Washington Post article, which says, quote, the fissures in the chain of command foreshadow the hazards for Putin of a drawn out war with high casualties, multiple military setbacks, and no clear end game, unquote. So given that, and given the desire on the part of President Volodymyr Zelensky and probably the entire nation to restore sovereignty to this country, to take back the territory that is theirs that Russia has tried to occupy, whether it's the Donbas and certainly the Crimea, what are your thoughts with regard to going forward? How optimistic are you that this war can have an end game, so to speak, and one that would satisfy both Ukraine and NATO and the West and somehow meet minimum expectations or requirements for Russia? Although I'm not even sure that's even necessary. Crimea is huge. Do you see a possibility of Ukraine recapturing the territory it needs?
Yes. So you're asking the $64 million question, which is, how does this war end and what does that look like? From the quote that you just gave from the Washington Post, and of course, very interested in Will's thoughts on this, Russia is now gotten signals that a stalemate conflict may serve their interests in terms of Ukraine not making a full turn to the West in terms of NATO membership. The administration, both President Biden and National Security Advisor Sullivan earlier this week at the summit, made it clear that while Ukraine is fighting this war based on the Russian invasion, that is not the time for them to join the alliance. So weighing, balancing that between what the Russians are willing to put up with over time in terms of attrition, losses, I think we've seen that the Russian military is not particularly concerned with massive casualties. And if that can continue, is that their strategy moving forward? Are they hunkering down for the regions that they have illegally occupied and invaded and making this a long war of attrition? We shall see. I think that President Zelensky is in a position right now where he has to, and his military and his people have to give 110% all the time. I understand the Ukrainian perspective of they won all the territory back, and I could not agree more. What that ends up looking like at the end of the day and what this conflict resolution is anyone's guess. I hope it ends tomorrow, but unfortunately, what it looks like is it's not going to end for a good time.
It's not going to end for a good time. Will Pomerantz, this conflict, you get the last word with respect to what the end of the war looks like. And do you really think that given all the weaknesses that have been revealed in Putin's regime in the Kremlin, that they are basically hunkering down for a war of attrition or some kind of a frozen conflict? Is that even possible?
I think they're hunkering down. Whether they actually have the resources to hunker down is a big question. So when Putin tried to have a mobilization because he said he needed more troops on the battlefield, the Russians didn't run to their local draft office. They ran to the airport and tried to get out of Russia as fast as possible. So whether Putin has the manpower and the resources to win this war, I think, is an open question. One has to remember that Russia now is defending a 600-mile territory because of the annexation of the Donbas and Luhansk and so forth. And whether Russia is capable of doing that is also an open question. I think the real issue, or one of the main issues going forward, is just how isolated Russia becomes as a result of this war. It has been expelled or left many international institutions. It has lost the most favored trade nation status that they fought for years. I think that Russia will emerge isolated and is focusing essentially on internal issues, whether it be going after foreign agents or whether it means creating courses about statehood and Russia as a different civilization separate from the West. So I think Russia most likely will emerge even more isolated, and that will have very important ramifications, because how do you deal with an inward isolated Russia?
On that cautiously optimistic note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guests, Catherine Sendak, Director for Transatlantic Defense and Security at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and Will Pomerantz, director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Thank you for a brilliant conversation. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.